Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now. Hey, hey, hey. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm Amanda Dell, one of the co-hosts of Recommended Reading and the co-director of Food Book Fair. Speaking of which, Recommended Reading is not all we do. We have our main event, Food Book Fair, our annual food media festival. This year we held it at Ace Hotel New York, which was an incredible venue. Shout out to Ace Hotel. Thanks for having us. And today we are pumped because we're getting to share on Recommended Reading our keynote panel at Food Book Fair. It's called What We Talk About When We Talk About Eating. And it took place on Friday, May 12th in Liberty Hall at Ace Hotel. Our friends James Ellis and Chris Black of Public Announcement recorded this keynote panel live. They shared it on their podcast, publicannouncement.org. And now we're incredibly thrilled to get to share it with our Recommended Reading listeners. So sit back, relax, enjoy. This is our keynote panel from Food Book Fair 2017, What We Talk About When We Talk About Eating.
We were there for the keynote, kicking off the fair with a panel discussion titled
What We Talk About When We Talk About Eating.
That's co-director Kimberly Chow. She described the panel as
an exploration about how we eat, cook, produce, distribute, document food today in the U.S., in the world in 2017.
The panel featured major names from the food world.
You know, these people are truly, truly dedicated to the game, passionate and well-spoken, and not just about cooking, but about the business and the politics of it all.
I loved it. You know, I love a good panel discussion.
And as a general interest podcast, I think it's very important to share this access with the global listenership.
Yeah, well, let's introduce everyone.
You'll be hearing from Mario Batali,
the chef, restaurateur, philanthropist, wearer of many, many hats.
And Crocs. Dr. Maisha Priest,
an associate professor at NYU, an author. She teaches about the politics of food.
Ken Friedman,
restaurateur, owner of the Breslin Bar and Dining Room, John Dory Oyster Bar within Ace Hotel, the Spotted Pig, as well as many other fine establishments.
Samin Nosrat,
who is a teacher, a cook, author most recently of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat.
Heavy hitters.
Major names.
And Frank Bruni as moderator.
Very major. But let's get to it. Kim can introduce Frank.
Let's go to the Ace Hotel's Liberty Hall.
And moderated by our fearless moderator tonight, Frank Bruni, columnist for the New York Times and author of, most recently, A Meatloaf in Every Oven. I'll let Frank take it away. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us tonight. I got to correct one thing. You said I'm a columnist for the New York Times. I'm a columnist for the failing New York Times.
The fake news failing New York Times.
Fake news. Thank you all for being here. The very title of tonight's event sort of suggests that eating in some ways has become more complicated. people come at it with much more sophistication. Ken, you've been in this business for a long time. You opened the Spotted Pig in 2004, but you've opened restaurants in recent years. How does opening a restaurant these days differ from back then, and how's that reflective of this evolving food scene?
Opening a restaurant now is harder just because it's more, everything's more expensive. We've opened a few restaurants. Opening restaurants to us is kind of like making albums. You know, you make the first album was The Spotted Pig, and that was kind of all the ideas that we had for our whole lives. And then, as Frank and I were just talking about, the second album we made was the first John Dory, which failed. You know, we had to remix it and move it to here. It's just, you know, every time you open a new restaurant, it's unless you recreate something, it's a new idea, and you never know if it's really going to work or not. If you open restaurants to kind of creatively satisfy yourself, that's what happens. But it's just more expensive. Rent's more expensive. If you want to be in a neighborhood that's full of people wandering around, the rent's high and everything is more expensive.
But what about the expectations and the sophistication of diners? Are there things you could get away with back in 2004 that you can no longer get away with now?
Well, I mean, in a place like New York City or San Francisco where you have a place, or L.A., which is, you know, a super hot food town now, there's just so many choices people have. So you can either kind of follow and do a poke restaurant or do an avocado toast restaurant, or you can think of a new idea and do something brand new and hope it works, and it sometimes doesn't. You have to be really good at it and do something that gets people to not just walk by your place and go to the place next door.
Samin, your book just came out, what, 3 weeks ago?
Yes.
By the way, I've heard amazing, amazing things about this book. Congratulations
on it.
Thank you. You were working on it for a very, very long time, right?
Yes.
We have brought so much more science into the kitchen, and I think that's reflected sort of in your book's title. How much do you think our evolving, you know, our greater understanding of the science of cooking is actually serving what we eat and helping you write a book that's going to be more helpful to home cooks?
I think all eaters have become much more sophisticated, and certainly home cooks. And I think science is a great tool for us. My approach is, I'm not a scientist. I actually don't feel that confident in my science. I did a lot of homework and reading and filtering and trying to put it into everyday language that I could understand and hopefully you could understand, because I think it helps to know why you're making decisions. And I think that's what's missing from a lot of recipes and from a lot of cookbooks. And I think that's the way to become more independent and able to trust your instincts and your senses. But I do think there's a place where, you know, there's a limit, right? And at some point, maybe knowing all of the science or knowing why every single thing is happening or how to make every single tiny little perfect thing is kind of too much for the average home cook. And it becomes work instead of joyful. And for me, everything is in service of joy and pleasure and bringing people together. So if you know that adding salt to your vegetables will draw water out and cause them to steam in the pan, but what you're trying to do is brown them, then don't do it. Yeah. And if you know that you can make that choice, and that can help you make a more delicious dinner for your family and your loved ones, then I think that's great. But I don't know. I'm not that fussy. I'm pretty unfussy. So I'm about making science be a tool, but that's it.
Along those lines, what's the most common mistake that you think people make in the kitchen that's easily avoidable, but people are just in the dark?
Well, I think probably it's that most people I see, they don't preheat their pans when they're cooking. And so it's really important to preheat your pan and then preheat the fat and then put your food in so that it can start browning more quickly and cooking more quickly. It's respecting your fat. And a lot of times it keeps your food from sticking to the pan. And people just a lot of times think, oh, I'm in such a hurry, let me just get my food in there. But actually it'll cook more quickly and more evenly if you wait a second for it to heat up.
Mario, you do cookbooks, you do food TV, and of course you do restaurants. Which of those realms has changed the most over the course of your career?
Well, they've all changed a bit, but I would say the restaurant business has changed the most. And echoing what Ken said, it's not just the cost, though, but it's when we opened Poe, no one was anxiously awaiting for us to open the door. So you had a chance to warm up a little bit and kind of get your feet underneath you before the breathless throngs, before the critics, and before, I mean, at this point, they have the plywood report. Like, hold on, there's plywood in that window. We must know more about this restaurant. It's just like, let them breathe a little bit. They're probably doing some reconstruction in there. There's a lot more intense excitement, or at least interest, in things as they open immediately, which doesn't give them a lot of chance to kind of percolate. So that means you really have to kind of presuppose what you're going to do, and you have to be probably more practiced than you had to be when I opened Poe in 1993.
Is there a restaurant you've opened that you think was really hurt and undermined by all of that breathless attention that comes right at the start or even the plywood phase?
No. I wouldn't say that they are all...
May I suggest one or two? Just kidding.
No. I don't think it was hurt. I just don't think we were ready.
Which one?
I would say La Serena. We weren't quite ready because we weren't really as cognizant of the specificity of the message we should have developed. We thought we would make really good Italian food, but everyone came to expect from me and my team something with far more defined opinion about something very, very specific. And now we have that, but it took us a year and some tepid criticism to realize that. And it was, because it was such a big place, I was trying to appeal to a larger mass, which in my heart I know now, and I assumed then, but I tried to get over it, is completely wrong.
Is there a restaurant that there's no longer a market or an appetite for? And Ken, if you have a feeling about this, I'd be curious to hear.
You mean a genre of restaurants? Or
a kind of restaurant, a genre, an altitude of restaurant that just won't make it anymore in a city like this or in most American cities?
I mean, I think if something is really done well, like I mentioned, poke places or all-day breakfast places are happening now a lot. The best one will survive and the other ones will go away. You know, I mean, I think I'm more of a design guy, you know, and I mean, Bear Edison light bulbs like we have in here, those are sort of over and taxidermy.
Nice work, Ken. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. That's from like Williamsburg 15 years ago. Those.
I'll step in just a little bit. I would say that restaurants that purport to be something for everybody are the ones that are kind of going away, where they have the Caribbean part and the Italian part and the French part and the pizza part and the Southeast Asian part. Because when Lydia Shire did that 25 years ago, it was because she was erudite and well-informed. Now it's more like it's a watered-down version of all of those, none of which are that well exposed, expressed, or even well-thought.
But also, on the other hand, those restaurants that just do one thing, like champagne and chicken or French fries or, you know, I think there were a lot of those for a while. And in London especially, there were a lot of those. And I think just they all kind of went away except for like the one. There's that one French fry place in East Village that's the best one, Pommes Frites. All the other ones went away. So I think that idea that where you just do one thing is a little bit silly for the most part.
Maisha, you were going to talk about the politics of food, which is what you write about, what you teach about. But since we're on the subject of restaurants and you're not a restaurateur but a consumer, what bothers you most about the New York restaurant scene?
Gosh, I didn't expect to be thinking about from the perspective of a consumer, but I think...
What pisses you off?
What pisses me off?
What do you hate?
I guess pretension and odd claims to mastery. Someone, for example, travels to another country for a summer and learns from the folk in whatever country it is and then comes back and is marked on their website as a master in whatever cuisine. I have a lot of suspicion about that for a number of reasons. I think the idea of mastery of another cuisine that perhaps someone's been cooking for a lifetime. They've inherited knowledge from aunties, from grandmothers. That's a kind of mastery you can't really get from a more touristic experience. And yet that's often the voice of cuisines that we hear as consumers in the United States and especially in New York City. And I think it's a striking and strange thing because New York City is such an international city that in fact we could hear voices of cuisines in different ways, but we don't seem to. So I have a lot of suspicion about that. I actually, when I first moved to New York, I loved the restaurants that had like pizza and sushi because I just couldn't understand that. And I thought that it was the most...
Nor could they.
And I would just walk around and sort of marvel, like, how are these cuisines cooked in the same kitchen? You don't even use the same kind of herbs, you know, what is it? But I did come to love that part of New York City as a sort of zany mismatching. And so I will miss those when they go, those odd restaurants that have, you know, Caribbean food and, you know, champagne or whatever. Because I feel like that's part of the personality of New York City. That weirdness. And I'm not sure that I want everything to be so smooth and so streamlined and so easily identifiable.
How does one define or draw the line between paying respect to another cuisine and casually exploiting it?
Good question.
My questions
Frank.
Don't seem like everybody else's questions.
It's because Ken gave me a martini before.
Oh. Well, you know, he also gave me sparkling wine, but it didn't have that effect on me. I think There are a couple of things. I mean, one thing that's important to me when I see claims made on menus or websites about cuisines that are either American, right? That's one way of naming something, or not, right? Exotic cuisines, is their association or the removal from history and geography. Some of you may have seen there was a really interesting article in the past week or so in the failing New York Times.
About fake news.
So perhaps
either
this
works.
Wasn't
failing
true,
fake news. We respond to it all.
About Asian food, right? Why is Asian food on the menu? I think that was the title of the piece, and it talked about this weird homogeneity in how we. Governor Tsao's, is it General Tsao's chicken? Oh, sorry, right. I'm a vegetarian, so
you do recognize chickens. Though.
I do. Oh, okay, I do. But why there's a certain kind of homogeneity in the way that we present those across the board. And so Asia is this imagined territory from which these foods come. But in fact, Asia has a number of countries in it, right? It has Japan, it has China, it has Vietnam, it has parts of India. There are lots of Asian foods, right? So I always feel concerned when there's no geography in a dish, when it's African. I mean, Africa is an imagined place, really, because it's full of nations, right? I also really wonder when there's no history attached to a dish. Nicholas and I actually worked together on a dessert, which was an amazing honor for me. And that was one of the things that we tried to think about. How do you use a history to which we're all associated with these histories, right? How do you make use of it without appropriating it?
As you were talking about that, Mario, I couldn't help but think about your most recent cookbook, which is all about regional cuisines, regional dishes. Is there one of those dishes that the history of which, the story behind it, particularly fascinated you?
I think just about everything from New Orleans is that for me, because it's such a mishmash. And I found that a lot about the Southwest, just because I love the flavors and I love the way that they come together, even though Southwest cooking isn't really Mexican and it really isn't Texan and it really isn't any part of the Southwest. But I think my question that's kind of, I hear a lot about cultural appropriation, and it seems to me that it's being approached as a sin. And as a cook, is authenticity my highest goal? Imagine I was a painter and I traveled to Africa and then I traveled to China. Using some of those influences in an unpure way, is that wrong? I mean, is cultural appropriation the bad word that everyone seems to throw it around me is feeling?
What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, you know, there'd be no Rolling Stones or Beatles or, you know, if they weren't influenced by what was happening in the South in America. I mean, people steal ideas from each other. You know, that's just what happens. I think it's a good thing. Imitation is the purest form of flattery, or however it goes. So, yeah, I think it's good.
I feel really complicated about this question, and I think some of it comes down to language. And I was just having a conversation on Twitter about this with somebody. And
Donald Trump?
Yeah. it forced me to go back and actually read a definition of cultural appropriation, which I've been one of those people really angry about it, you know. And I realized I also could be accused of that. I lived in Italy for 2 years and I made pasta every day of my life for 10 years. So I think of myself as a pretty good pasta maker, but I'm not Italian, you know. And so do I deserve to get to say that I'm a pretty good pasta maker? I don't know.
Hell yes.
But I think appropriation, so much of it is about lack of respect and lack of acknowledgement, whereas maybe cultural influence, or what are some other words for, what are the, like, what, there's so many gray areas. I feel like you will probably know a lot of this language very well.
None of it is really sufficient, but I think that the idea of thinking of yourself as collaborating with those from whom you're borrowing and acknowledging the borrowing is an important part of it, right? I mean, when one of the things that I thought about when you asked that question is Picasso, for example, in his Cubist work. Most people don't know that he's really influenced by African art. Sure. And that's important.
There was that fantastic exhibit at the MoMA maybe 30 years ago, and you walked in and you said, so that's where he got all of this stuff.
But the reason that it's important is because we don't think of Africa as a place from which art comes. And that has everything to do with how we think about the hierarchy of culture and the value of African cultures. So it's not a problem that he was influenced and inspired by African art, because it's, like all kinds of art, incredibly beautiful. The problem is that it's unnamed, and that we start valuing art, valuing what appears to be African art, only when we see it through the lens of Picasso. right? And so it is a very tangled, I mean, I can't imagine what in my kitchen is rightfully mine, right?
But is it important, though? I mean, do you have to write footnotes to all of the things that you do to belie the fact that you've been influenced by all these people? I mean, I remember the very first time I've listened to Tom Waits all of my life, as long as I possibly could. I remember the first time I went to a klezmer concert, and I'm like, huh, that's where he got it all. But I don't feel that he stole it from them. He just happened to have picked up a lot of the quirky nuance that I find that culture. But I don't feel that he had to say, by the way, I've spent some time in klezmer music circles.
I think for me, one of the reasons it is important is because when we establish the value of not just cuisines, but the cultures who make them, that has political consequence. So right now we're in a moment where we have certain rights that are enshrined in our Constitution, but we're learning they don't apply equally to each kind of person. So when we don't value people equally, it can have life or death consequences for certain people. And so I think that's why it's important to name your influences and your collaborators, because their invisibility makes them less politically important, less politically visible. And in some cases, that can mean annihilation or death in certain ways. For me, there isn't anything more important than naming those to whom you are connected, right? I don't think of it as theft, because I think that we're influenced by this amazingly diverse world that we live in. But I think that the erasure of those connections is enormously consequential.
Simi, since we're sort of on the subject of ethnic cuisines, in the research, in the cooking for your book, was there a genre, an ethnicity of cooking that most surprised you and that you came to believe we understand the least well?
Oh, man. I cannot speak for everyone.
For you.
For me, absolutely. You know, I'm a geek. I'm a total geek. And I love sort of following threads and imagining how geography has affected things and history has affected things. And so there are certain tastes and geographies and cultures that I have maybe spent more time digging back through. And absolutely, I felt really weak in my knowledge of various South American and Caribbean cuisines, of West African cuisines. In fact, we have a few charts in the book that are sort of like they're almost like flavor maps of the world, of different fats and acids and spices used around the world. And my collaborator, Wendy McNaughton, she's an illustrator, but she's had this incredible past, including she did a lot of social work and nonprofit work in Africa, in West Africa. And so I just sort of jotted down on my first round all of the countries I could think of and all the foods that I could think of. And she wrote back to me. She said, we can't publish this. Where's Africa? Like, that's a huge part, you know. And so it really became something I became deeply aware of not knowing about. And then I became really paranoid. So I went and did a whole bunch of homework. But it's a big world. And it's, I think, as curiosity is the thing that guides us forward, I think it's okay. You know, like, we're all going to make mistakes, but yeah.
I want to ask a question. I want all of you to answer it, you know, one by one. But I think acknowledged by the title of this panel is, more than ever, I think we find our self-image in how and what we eat, both in and out. Ken, when you look at how you eat, whether it's in or out, what tells us something about your values and what's the key to who you are in the way you approach food?
Wow, that's a great question. I was trying to get the bartender's attention and get you another martini, so I wasn't really focusing on it. But
we're halfway home. I can put down another one. Yeah,
another martini, please.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
In terms of how you approach eating out or eating in, where do we see Ken Friedman? Where do we see the distinctive personality and values of Ken Friedman?
It's changed a lot now that I'm in the business. You know, I mean, my whole adult life, I was sort of obsessed with and fascinated by public assembly in general. And I went from kind of clubs, because I was in the music business for a long time, you know, to kind of restaurants, which are sort of clubs for adults. You sit instead of stand, and you eat instead of take drugs. You know, I always loved great food and kind of fancy food, but I never really dressed up. So I was always the one going to restaurants and being told, sorry, you need to wear a jacket. And I never understood why. And so when I thought about for years opening my first place, it was, you know, a place that I wanted to go to, you know. And I think great artists make art for themselves, not for anybody else. You know, I don't think Bob Dylan, you know, thinks I'm going to make a song like the radio sounds today. So I made a place that I wanted to go to. And now that I'm older, I sort of like getting dressed up and having a date night and going to a fancy place. And I don't mind sort of making a reservation in advance. And the problem with getting older for me is I don't want to eat all that rich food. because I'll get fat, especially now that it's summer. When I go out now, I just try to eat the simplest kind of stuff. I like to go to Chinatown. We like to go to Queens. I sort of want to avoid kind of like hip, fancy, trendy restaurants that have avocado toast and poke.
Mario, what's a facet or habit of your eating life that tells us a lot about you?
As the elder spokesperson for this group...
How old are you?
I'm 56. When?
Look a day over 55, I swear.
Thank you very much.
I would say that over the last 20 years, what used to fascinate me the most was what the chef did to manipulate the product. I was as much about technique as I was about the location, as I was about the lighting, as I was about the wine list, as I was about the music. And at this point in my life, I am far less interested in the frippery or the technical components of the chefiness of things, both at my house and when I go to restaurants. And I'm far more interested in the authenticity or the remarkableness of a product itself, all by itself raw. Whereas I used to try and go and order the fancy stuff, which all over the 3-star Michelin restaurants in the 80s was foie gras and caviar and smoked salmon. At this point, I like foie gras when I'm in Les Landes. I like the kind of oyster that grows in Bologna when I'm in Bologna. I like the kind of ragnolotti that's in Torino when I'm in Torino. So I'm more looking for things that tell me the story of the place and aren't not necessarily jacked up by technique, but are more about the simple ingredients of that time of the year and about that kind of confidence of cook.
We were talking, I'd like to kind of bring a conversation that you and I had on the sidelines out to the stage, in terms of this self-image and food and all that. We were talking about how politicians, how part of the politics of food is politicians saying a lot about their identities through what they telegraph to the world about what they eat. Have you noticed that with the current president, with the last president? What would you say about that?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think we've all seen those, you know, the very regular gestures of presidents stopping in certain places to have food. And it's never foie gras. It's always fried chicken or hot dogs or pizza or pancakes, right? It's very class-marked food. It's food that marks those presidential candidates as, or associates them with the working class, right, with the regular guy.
Regular people.
Yes. And as we talked about, both Trump and Bush W. worked hard to cultivate this image when, in fact, they were as far from a sort of quote-unquote regular person as you could get as far as class is concerned. And so I think it's a really important and sort of continuous gesture of presidential, of politicians, period, right, to mark themselves through these performances of eating food. I thought Obama's was particularly interesting. You know, there were all kinds of cartoons about he and Michelle, and I don't know if some of you might remember the one where they showed Michelle, they made her heavier than she is, and she was kind of lurking over this hamburger. Obama was sitting there and, you know, identified by the cartoon, by his big ears, and he was eating like a piece of lettuce. So he had a piece
not,
of lettuce.
Not his nightly plate. Seven almonds that we read
not
about.
Not the almonds, not the almonds, just a piece of lettuce. So they had him as a kind of, you know, aesthete, and her as this sort of greedy gourmand. And it was a really strange sort of talk back, I guess, to the ways in which they used food to try to mark themselves as the people's president and first lady, right? But one of the interesting things we were talking about on the sidelines is how I'm sure everybody's seen, or most of us have seen, when Obama lands in Hawaii, his home state, and he has the shaved ice, right, to land himself. That, you know, that's, for me, that I'd have a burrito. I'd land in San Francisco. I'd go straight to the mission, right? So we all have these practices that mark us and bring us home. But his is so interesting because shaved ice is it's the mark of the conqueror, right, for lack of a better word. Ice and its entrance into Hawaii was a very concerted and conscious way to drive Hawaiians away from their indigenous foods. And it became a mark of privilege and power to have ice. So it's just amazing that then the president of the United States, who wants to make this claim to us through the eating of this dessert, that he's one of the people, is eating this really complex dessert. I mean, it couldn't be more complicated.
But it isn't, though. The dessert itself isn't.
It's
the
not
history
complicated.
Of exactly. The ice is complicated.
Ice is complicated.
Eating ice right now is what the poor
right.
people eat.
Right.
So, I mean, it's well, not, I mean, don't get too confused about the historical perspective of the ice's introduction to being something that Obama is classlessly making a mistake.
Oh, I don't.
Eating
I
a
don't
$1
fault
cone,
him
right?
In that way.
All right.
No, but what I am saying is that ice is, ice in the tropics is complicated. Right. it's completely unnatural, I guess, is my point. Sort of establishing his presence through this dish is, I think, one way in which political candidates have expressed themselves through food.
While we're on the subject of the Obamas, you cooked a state dinner, right?
I did.
For the Obamas.
For the Obamas, the last one.
Tell us a little bit about that. What was most surprising about that whole experience?
The whole thing was glorious for me. It was my greatest moment as an American cook was to cook at the White House. And Mrs. Obama has been coming to our restaurants for a long time, a little bit less the president himself, but she's a big foodie, and that's why she was portrayed as the chummy gourmand huzzing over that burger. But going through the menu ideas with her and her group of like 10 best friends was a presentation that was fraught with a lot of nerves, and we had a really good time, and she finally chose a couple of dishes, and then we went down to make them, and I'm like, well, so when do we drive the truck in with all the prep food? And they're like, you don't drive a truck into the White House, asshole. So we had to order all the food raw, and then with four people that I was allowed, make dinner for 400 people in 24 hours, which was a more grueling task than I expected. And then they direct you to the Navy Mess, which is the West Wing cooking group. And they're basically Navy SEALs who are ready to do whatever you want. So you're like, I have an army of Navy SEALs. I'm like, all right, so guys, when we chop parsley, we stand like this, and they all go like this. I'm like, I was joking, put your leg down. And it was a great experience. The White House is a serious place. They have serious ones. Well, it was, you're right. Now, it's not. But it was a great experience, and they are fantastic. They were fantastic in their presidential world, and I look forward to seeing what they're going to do now. And a lot of people say, well, would you go cook at the White House for the present president? And my answer is, of course, I would go to the White House because I value the office more than any inhabitant, no matter what, because I'm a big-time lover of the American ideology, even in the bad days or the good days. And you have to look past that at all times, even though at 120 days, I'm fucking exhausted.
Samin, if you had to cook, if you were called on to cook for the current president, what would you make him? And I don't mean a mini pie. What would you make him and why?
I'd probably make him Persian food. My family's from Iran. Yeah. It's really delicious, and it's undeniably delicious, and I think that would probably be the most powerful statement that I could make, is to make, I have had a lot of relatives who've been harassed, I've been harassed, I think a lot of times actions speak louder than words, so if I were able to cook, that would probably be the most powerful thing I could do, yeah.
Ken or Mario, has either of you had Melania or Donald in your restaurants?
I've seen him at other people's restaurants.
Which restaurants?
The 21 Club. That's where he goes. That's where he has his well-done steak or his well-done hamburger. He sits around. He shakes a lot of hands. He tells everybody he's going to cut their taxes. And then he leaves. Before and now.
Does he pay the check before he leaves?
I've never seen him pay the check. But I'm sure he did. Like, I wouldn't dispute.
I'm not so sure. I've met a lot of people who've been stiffed. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's that puts him even lower than I thought. That makes him even a lower guy than I thought.
Let's open this up to questions from you all for any of these four. Do you want this microphone or do you have a microphone? Okay. Will you pick the people? Because you're out there.
We have time for a couple.
Back here.
So if anyone has a question and wants to be the first brave one to go, raise your hand. I'll come over.
How about Naz in the red jacket?
Okay.
I just wanted to follow up on the cultural appropriation bit. More than anything, I think we are all very uncomfortable talking about race, and it's less about influence than it is about white people taking something that a brown person has had in their culture, or a black person or a yellow person in their culture for years, and saying that they discovered it in a way, right? So I experienced this firsthand when all of my friends on Instagram started making cuckoo sabzi this spring because Bon Appetit did a video on it. And it was like, at first I was like, yay, I'm Iranian. Iranian food, everybody's recognizing it. And then I was like, oh my God, no. In like 5 years, no one will even know cuckoo sabzi was an Iranian thing. It'll be like in some white dude's restaurant. And I think that that's definitely an important aspect of it. And I'm curious if that changes, specifically Mario, because you seem to think that it was more about influence. And that line is a little bit different, actually.
Well, I would say that if a really great dish from the Philippines or from a particular province in China or from Iran or from West Africa or from South America, Chile, for example, comes our way and we adopt it as a delicious dish, I don't think that it loses its cultural identity. I just think that there's a bunch of other people making it, and that doesn't necessarily denigrate it or make the practitioners of making that dish wrong. I don't think the Italians feel embarrassed, although they're slightly insulted by the crappy lasagna we serve here. I don't think that they feel that we've culturally appropriated anything in a way that dismisses their the depth of their culture, nor the skill of the originators of that fantastic recipe. So I look at it a little differently, but that's because I'm a borrower, not, I don't ever take credit for this stuff. I always look at the work that I do as interpreting 2,000 or 3,000 years of gastronomic cultural history in the Italian culture. I don't say, hey, look, I invented this. I mean, my signature dishes like beef cheek ravioli are based on ravioli brisato from the Piemonte. And I use things that are from here, but I don't think that I've certainly intended, if I did, to insult anybody. And that idea that we're appropriating things and stealing them and dismissing people is well beyond what any cook would ever think they were doing. They're trying to bring something delicious from somewhere they went to people that they think might appreciate it without ever intending to hurt, insult, or denigrate a culture. I can guarantee you that.
How would you, any of you, say that you should preserve the history of your food in the face of appropriation?
Well, as a cook, I don't feel that my job is necessarily to preserve the entire timeline of the Italian culture. My job is to provide deliciousness in a way that can provoke and delight people right now. That said, in the historical perspective of academia, there is an entirely different way of looking at it. But I don't feel that I need to look at it that way, although I'm fascinated by academia. But I'm out here trying to make people have a good time at dinner. So I'm not necessarily tied that much, nor am I insulted when someone makes a bad dish of Italian food and calls it something that I know it's not.
I would want to add that I think, I mean, it is, academics are preoccupied with things that other people are not. And by the way, we don't have wine and flowers at our panels, so I'll try to bring that influence into future engagements. But I think one of the reasons for me that it's important is because food is one of the most crucial justice issues of our time. And so it matters how we think about it, how we produce it, how we represent it. In each individual kitchen, obviously that weight would be too heavy, right, for a dish of pasta. But I feel like the consciousness of it, the conversations around it, the ways in which we imagine ourselves moving forward will determine how we, in fact, enact this kind of food justice, this food sustainability that we're all talking about in all these various ways. I feel like it's something that's gotten put aside in this conversation about appropriation is how it helps us think about what subjects are important, right? So one of the things that I think about is the symbolic life of food. How do we show it to ourselves in movies, books, commercials, cartoons, even cookbooks is one of the genres that I study. And if you think about, for example, a movie like The Help, which is an iconic movie at this point, it is about the freedom of the central character and her finding her voice, right? The Emma Stone character. But what makes that possible is the black women who feed her. And whether they eat or not, or whether their children eat or not, is not central to the movie at all, even though the context of the movie is the black civil rights movement. And so the reason it's important is because if we can't conceive of all of those women, not just the Emma Stone character, but the black women who are feeding her and the children who those women are not feeding as a consequence, as a part of our justice movement, then we won't make justice ever, right? Unless we begin to incorporate other kinds of subjects into our imagination. And I feel like that's why it's important. It's not that we all need to feel guilty or we need to feel torn and rend our garments and stop cooking and stop making the things that we're making. But I think that in making these kinds of things that we all make in restaurants, in dishes, in cookbooks, in movies, we're creating the landscape of our imagination from which we enact our policies. And so that, to me, makes it enormously important and enormously consequential, not just, you know, in each of our kitchens, but as we do it more broadly as a culture.
We have time for one more quick question. We have time for one more quick question.
I think this is a quick question. It's basically just, and I'm just wondering about the idea of people who do go to other cultures, other countries, and they're not necessarily trying to appropriate, but when they come back, they want to share. And so whether it's at a restaurant or something like that, they can't necessarily share the history and the culture with every dish. but maybe they're saying this, you know, this is so wonderful from this place that I just came from that I want to share it. And by having a delicious dish, that's your first step to understanding where it came from. And then when you're interested, you start, you know, asking questions and finding out more. So is there a fair middle ground there? If it's not being bastardized, this, you know, the foods, it, but if they're being slowly introduced in a way that Americans can understand or accept, is that acceptable?
Man, this is such an awesome stuff that we're talking about. And I think about this stuff all the time. And one thing for me, I'm not a restaurateur, but I write and I try to tell people stories and I'm always listening to stories. And one thing that I've learned is that I might hear someone's story and think it's really amazing and think, oh, I got to tell that story. And that's kind of appropriation. Whereas if I can create for this person a way to tell his or her own story or create a platform for a person to tell their own story, that is accomplishing my goal of sharing this very interesting and amazing thing, but I'm not taking it over. And so I think the same thing can be said for restaurants or any other medium in which we share culture and influences, which is, what if instead of saying, oh, wow, I went to Mexico and I had these amazing tacos, I'm going to come serve them at my Chinese restaurant or whatever, I don't know. What if you're like, I'm going to have one night where I invite these grandmas to come make these tacos and I'm going to like share their thing with the press that I have access to, and that's how I'm going to give them a platform to speak for themselves. Yeah, so.
Thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that special rebroadcast of our keynote panel at Food Book Fair 2017. We will be back next week with a live episode, and thank goodness I'll be rejoined by my co-director of Food Book Fair and co-host of Recommended Reading, Kimberly Chow, because I know I've missed her. So we'll be very excited to welcome her back to the airwaves next week on Recommended Reading. And be sure to check out foodbookfair.com. We have all of our Green Market signings listed there, as well as a link to prior Recommended Reading shows, and also ways to get in touch if you want your book or magazine or film or other podcast to be involved in Food Book Fair 2018. Again, check out foodbookfair.com. And thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.